Michael Woodward, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Another expat friend.
Yeah.
Great to have found you in Algarve. We've had some good meetups, haven't we, over the last couple of years, I think
it is.
Yeah. It's just great to meet so many cool people here, and they keep continuing to do so. And I've wanted to have a chat with you on the show for a while. Tell us, Michael, how have you ended up in Portugal? How have you ended up in Algarve with all of the other cool heads that are flocking to this most western tip of Europe and our own little hideaway?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I'll try and keep it as short as I can. What happened is that I left England 24 years ago, lived in Florida. 13 years I was there and I loved it, and I saw the demise of America coming, so I looked for another place to live and I searched the world. I mean, I'd go online and I'd study every country that I could live, because it's not about just living there, it's about getting a visa. Sometimes the visas cost a lot of money. You've got to have 2 or 3 million in the bank, that kind of thing. So I ended up, I wanted to come back to Europe to be near my family. And I thought Spain, and then the other side of the world was Belize. So I booked a ticket to Belize. And I thought, well, I know Spain. I've been there many, many times when I was younger. And that week I met a tarot reader. And she did my cards, and she put the cards out. And she says, "What, are you going to move?" He goes, "Yes." I said, "That's the reason I'm here, really. I'm finding out we're a bit uncomfortable about my decisions. I'm not sure." So she went, "Okay, so where's your first choice?" She said, "Spain." I said, "No, you're not going to live in Spain. No, you're not going to live in Belize." When I left, I thought, this is very strange. And we'd had a long conversation afterwards, and she said, "Why don't you just wait for a sign?" I said, well, I'm into that, you know, synchronicity. And so I thought, okay, I'll go back to Florida for a week and say goodbye to all of, because I was living in Panama then. And I thought, I'll go see my friends. So I arrived there. My ex-girlfriend, she's a real estate lady and everything else. I said, how are you doing? She said, oh, I've just come back from Portugal. And I said, no, I've never been there. She says, it's really nice. I went to Lagos, and it's a little town and some friends there. And that was really it. Thought nothing of it. Following day, I met a friend who was a dancer, and she's traveled the world. And she says, where are you going to live? I says, well, Belize or Spain. She says, no, Michael, I know you really, really well. She said, you've got that, feminine side that's, you would hate living in Spain. So I've been there. He said, no. She said, you hate living in Spain. Because basically it's a very macho society. She said, next time you go over, go to a little place in Portugal called Lagos. Go. That's funny, that's twice.
Wow.
Within 24 hours.
That was the sign.
Blow me. At 4 o'clock, I met my American ex-wife, and she said, oh, you know, my son-in-law, the geeky one who did some software, has just sold his company for $250 million. And he's paid off my mortgage, and I'm going off round Europe to find a place to live. And I'm going to a little place called Lagos. I don't believe this. So I went home, and I got on my computer when I returned back to Panama. And I went, wow, this is really good. I went, I'm going to Panama. I'm going to Portugal. So I literally got on the computer, booked a place for 3 months, and that was it.
How long
five
ago was
suitcases,
that?
That was 2016. And I got 5 suitcases, packed up, sold everything else, just jumped on a plane and just came. That's it. I knew no soul, and I just arrived.
Amazing.
And that was it.
Yeah, you've embedded yourself right into the local
culture
here. And it's
been like the best decision of my whole life.
Really?
Know? Oh, yeah. Incredible.
How have you found the hook? Because what I'm kind of wrestling with at the moment is this new idea of being an expat. Expatriate means you've left the fatherland, you've left home, and you've not been back to England, well, obviously other than visiting, living there for 24 years.
And, yeah.
And it's a much different experience, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
And I feel as if I've left a lot of baggage behind in the UK.
It's like, oh, yeah.
It's like a fresh start. But it's also meeting a lot of other people with the same ideas, and they've also thought that it's time to move on from their homeland. How have you found that being? Because that was the one thing I kind of, when you get homesick, and you do get a bit homesick, right? I don't really know what it is you get homesick for.
I don't.
But I think it's the land. I think it's the actual land itself, right? But
yes.
But I feel like I've severed a root.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I've severed a root, and I'm trying to grapple with that idea of now being almost a bit of a nomad. And did you ever have those thoughts initially when you first left 25 years ago?
Actually, no.
No.
And the reason, I think I'd traveled to Florida from 1979, right?
Mm.
I'd go every year. I'd go to Florida, I'd go to New York to do business or LA or whatever I was, and then I'd go to Florida for a few days or a holiday before I come back. So I've done that. I did that for 20 years.
Mm, before you moved
so there. I wanted to live there. You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't have that. You know, I was thinking, I'm getting sick of England.
Mm.
I got a huge tax bill one year. I was working on my own. It was 1983. I was selling art, and I worked with a company called Athena, and I was supplying art to them, posters and prints and greetings cards and
stuff. Athena, just to interrupt you there, Athena were famous in the 80s. I remember going to Athena poster shops.
Yeah.
Didn't they do the girl with the tennis ball in the knickers?
Yeah,
famous shot. Yeah.
Well, it was one of those things where I built up a really good reputation.
Hmm.
I had about 30, 40 artists working full-time. And so I was the only agent that could supply them fast enough with their cards and their prints and so on. Many other suppliers as well. I wasn't the only one, but I was up to one point, they told me I was doing half of their business in certain periods. And it was one of those things where I thought, I'm just working on my own, doing really, really well.
Mm.
And then I got a tax bill. And I'm thinking, it's like over half my income is just disappearing.
Is this in the UK?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is crazy. So I then started to read books on how to avoid paying so much tax, being intelligent and sensible about it. And I formed a company in England, in America, in Florida. And so my American business I did in America. So I'd fly to America and I'd work for America companies, and the money would come to the American company. It never came into England.
So this is in the late 70s?
This was 83.
Because that seems to me like the genesis of that whole digital nomad, which is very popular now. But back then, it was W.G. Hill. Do you ever remember that guy?
I've got all this book.
Yeah, you got all this book?
I got a pile of books like this.
Amazing.
Pile of books.
So P.T. Traveller. P.T. Traveller, yeah. So did you read about the P.T. stuff before you started doing...
It was during that period. That's when I got the tax bill.
Yeah.
And then I have this uncanny knack of when I want something...
It emerges.
It appears.
Yeah.
So basically this ad appeared where all the PT stuff. So I started reading the tax things and so on. I thought, this is cool. And it's an intelligent thing to do.
Mm.
All the billionaires and sensible millionaires, that's what they do. Why would they pay the taxes? You know, people have this idea that taxes are, oh, you're paying for services and you're paying for, I mean, most of it's just frittered away.
Well, right? not just frittered away. Most of it goes to pay the interest on the loans to the banks that are giving us fake money. So, you know, why would I want to give over my hard labour that I'm working hard to create, you know, the little bit of wealth that I can and hand it over to these obscenely rich bankers?
Exactly.
Why would I want to do that voluntarily, you know?
When you watch American Congress and the joke that goes on there and nothing ever gets done, you're thinking, my God, they're all getting paid huge, huge salaries and they do nothing, basically. So I know a little more about American politics than I do about British politics. I never took an interest in British politics at all. And I realised that Britain was going to go through some kind of immigration, became a problem like it is now in America.
Mm.
This is not about the immigrants themselves. Is to do with the policies of allowing so many people to come in the country. It changes the dynamic of every city. So I've just come back from, you know, Leeds and London for a week. And you walk around, you ask a question. You're not meeting any local people like you used to do in the old days when I grew up. They were all 90% Yorkshire people. Now it's a mixture.
It's been transformed.
Some ways, you know, some ways I like that, but in other ways, you sort of lose the identity of the town, the places, and so on. You have to go to the countryside. Luckily, I lived in the countryside, and I could afford a house in the country, away from all the cities. You see, I've never liked city life, you know, at all.
So you moved to America to escape the high tax regime in the UK.
No, that was partial reason.
Yeah.
The other reason, I love the sunshine. I love palm trees. I love beaches. And in England, you can't do that. You have to go on holiday.
Yeah.
So I was taking 3 to 4 holidays a year, flying over there, and I'm thinking, why don't I just live there? Mm. And there's this deep, not fear is the wrong word, but how is it going to be? There's this attachment, you know, because I was born and bred in Yorkshire. I was a real Yorkshireman, loved the countryside and so on. And you think,
see, this is what I was talking about before, about being an expat, is that it's that whole identity which in some ways has been severed, hasn't it? But you still have it. You still yearn for it.
It holds you from making the decision. Because I've asked people before, why don't you move? I've got my pension, I've got this, I've got that, I've got this, I've got that. It's all these ties. And literally when you move, the ties just, they weren't really there in the first place.
Yeah.
It's an illusion. Mm. So I started to work there and I did okay. Then the first year, 2001, right, was 9/11. So business was absolutely terrible. It was so bad. I had the only thing I had was credit cards. I had a very good credit rating. I had no money coming in because businesses were really, you know, in a terrible state. And I just lived off credit cards for over a year.
Good for you.
I ran up a massive bill. And that's another story, but I learned how to get out of debt, you know, very easily. But it's that's another story.
It's a good story. And I think it's valuable information that people need to know about, because once you discover that the banks create money out of thin air, that there is no loan, you know, then it's easy to offset that so-called money that's been created. And it's not what you think it is. And much deeper rabbit hole, maybe we can save that for.
There's many rabbit holes down there. There's the tax system with the IRS. There's the birth certificate system.
Yeah. But you went down that. I mean, that was one of the things that we initially started chatting about when we first met a couple of years ago. It was like you were doing the whole creditors in commerce in America. Was it like the mid-2000s or something?
Just after the 2008 crash.
2008 crash, because that's when I discovered it. It was 2010.
Yeah.
I discovered the whole, in the UK, it was the route into that information was like the Freeman on the Land, you know, the Freeman on the Land?
Yeah,
but in America, it was different, wasn't it? It was like the Freemen of Montana. They were the guys who kind of first kind of started developing the whole birth certificate.
There was this group of three guys. Jack Smith and Brandon, somebody else, another guy, and they started Creditors in Commerce, and they basically understood the basics of it. One of the people they were involved in with, I found out later, and I met him, right? This guru that they'd gone to, they put that guy in jail.
Winston Shrout, him.
And they drew, no, not Winston. I knew Winston. I met Winston. I went to Winston's thing, you know, all that. So the thing is that this other guy, I can't remember his name, they put him in jail. And these guys are clever enough to get him out. But he has to do it himself, right? You have to do it as a sovereign. Nobody can do it for you. And they drugged him. And basically he was in there for many, many years.
What was he in for doing things like A for V? Do you remember A for V?
He was teaching. Absolutely. He was teaching people and he was getting to a high level. And I can't remember which city. He did something and created a bond or something which would have bankrupted a whole city.
Yeah.
And they said, we've got to put this guy away.
Because, you know, the whole PT stuff kind of is almost like a gateway into the deeper rabbit holes of birth certificate. What does that mean? Because that's still not really been fully uncovered, has it? Because that was just the biggest rabbit hole I've ever been down, was understanding the birth certificate. And then you have the whole money creation, which is faking out of thin air. Then you have the the legal remedies that are available to us that people don't know about, trusts and the common law and all that stuff was really, really fascinating to me. Yeah. It seems like you went on a similar journey.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I'll tell you, this is good for other people watching because this will help them. When you start to look at it, there's so much to it. People go, oh, I can't deal with this, can't deal with this. So if they're interested in educating themselves, they need to buy a book called A Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. He was a scholar.
Amazing guy.
And he went deep into the Federal Reserve, its formation. And people think Creature from Jekyll Island is a horror thing book. There was a meeting of bankers. There were Warburg and J.P. Morgan and et cetera, et cetera. There's the main group. And apparently they had a meeting on Jekyll Island. That's why it's called that. One or two bankers didn't join. I think there was a guy called Astor, and there was another very, very wealthy individual. And I think that was why, I think it was not the Lusitania, the Titanic.
Yeah, they were on the Titanic.
And the Titanic disappeared. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Another conspiracy
classic
theory.
Conspiracy,
So the Jekyll Island book gives anybody a very great understanding of finance world and how it was created, that Federal Reserve is not federal.
Private.
And it's a private bank. And the Treasury asked the Federal Reserve to create money for them, and then they pay interest. Which is quite ridiculous.
And they collect the interest from our taxes.
Yes.
And that's the scam, isn't it? You know, that's the scam of it all. In The Creature from Jekyll Island, it's about the meeting that these bankers had on this private island where no one was watching in order to create the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
So and then from that, the bank, the Federal Reserve was created, which is like the Bank of England in the sense that it sounds like it's part of the nation, but it's not. It's a private entity run by private bankers having the monopoly to create the currency of the nation, which they then lend to the government on condition that it's paid back with interest. Yep. What an absolute scam that is.
Oh, it was. Well, the thing is, before that, they were having lots of problems. Because what you've got is a system where banks were collapsing, runs on the banks. Don't forget, there was the Depression.
Yeah.
And so they were trying to create a new system, and these bankers thought, oh, is this a way for us to control governments? So if you control the money, you control the people and you control the government. So they went to Woodrow Wilson, I think I've got that right, with basically the plan.
Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah. Woodrow Wilson signed it. And I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, you know, I basically sold America down the river, basically.
Wasn't that something like his deathbed quote or something, the thing he regretted most?
Regretted, because he'd given the reins of the country to these bankers, and we've seen what's happened since.
It's the biggest problem of our day. It's like everything else pales into insignificance. If you don't control your own money supply, you're not sovereign, are you? You can't be, because you know, you're beholden to somebody else. And the debtor-creditor relationship is rooted to the fact that a private company can issue currency for a nation and lend it at interest.
Well, the big scam they pulled then was the fact that, you know, if you went, he said, $1 will give you the equivalent amount in silver.
That's right, yeah.
In other words, it was a IOU for the silver. And that was real money, right? But what they did in the 70s with Nixon, they went off the gold standard, and basically then it's just paper money. You've got IOUs, fiat money, which are IOUs. And so most people have no clue about money itself and what it actually is. In other words, I think, oh, money, it's just a bit of paper that's it's an IOU for a dollar or a euro. And if you go to the bank, they'll give you another dollar or a euro. Whereas in the old days, the real reason of currency is you get some silver for that, real money, something of value. So this money is fiat money. It's of no value whatsoever, and it will collapse, and it is collapsing now.
Well, it was originally the paper money was a receipt.
Receipt, yes.
For the physical asset.
Yes.
Which was held by the bank, whether that was gold or silver.
Absolutely.
Right? And then, like you say, Nixon, they detached it from it. They finally give up the illusion and said, There is no money.
Yeah, I know.
We're bankrupt. All we've got are these bits of paper bits that of we paper. Can pass around to each other.
That's why bank is a scam. Yeah. You know, I said to, it's this lovely story. I arrive in Portugal, no bank account. Go to Santander. Walk in, see this manager, Miguel. And I said, I want to open a bank account. It's just basically for paying bills and things like that. I said, are you a good bank? He says, well, I think we are. I said, well, then, are you a good banker? He said, well, I think so. I says, do you know that banking is a scam? And he looked at me. I said, you know, because I will give you, say, 1,000 and you'll go loan out 9,000 based on the fact I put 1,000 in.
Fractional reserve banking.
You haven't got that. It's fractional reserve banking.
Yeah.
And I said, it's a scam.
No one knows about it.
I know. And he says, I do know, Michael.
Oh, did he?
And I went, oh, good. And we had a little chat about that. We'll buy you with that. And then I said, he'll do for me. And we said, oh, so I'm today. You know, we've become friends and I help him. I've been teaching about crypto.
Well, this really is the foundation of why crypto exists in the first place, isn't it? And why it's so beneficial to the people, especially Bitcoin, because it's one way to combat the fake fiat economy that we have been sold over these last 100 years.
Absolutely.
From the creature of Jekyll Island.
Yep.
Through to the 70s when they removed the gold standard and went to totally fiat.
Yeah.
And this is the counter. Now, we've kind of segued nicely into that topic because I know this is something that is, as long as I've known you, right, even when we were in the bear market, you were still very positive about crypto and Bitcoin and all of the others. And I haven't seen you without a smile on your face for the last couple of weeks because we're now back in the bull run.
Yeah.
Tell me about crypto. Tell me about your relationship with crypto, how you got into it, what your thoughts are now, and you know what information you can share with our listeners that will, you know, give them some good news.
I'd love to. Yeah. I've been banging this drum for 10 years, you know. So and most people don't listen.
Mm.
So my son we were in Florida, and he said, "I've got this new thing I've heard about called Bitcoin." So I read about it. I got the white paper. Satoshi Nakamoto's paper. I read the first page. From then on, you don't this gobbledygook to me. But this premise was amazing. It's a limited supply on a blockchain, which is a ledger, an account, which is basically created through cryptography. It's encryption. So it can't be altered. It can't be changed. That's a bit complex, so you don't want to get to that now for this podcast because it is a very technical process. Now, I only understand it on a certain level. Don't need to understand all this.
I don't think
this.
We need to know the technical.
It's like, you know, you drive a car. You don't need to know how everything works, you know. So I know the basics. So basically, I saw the premise of this would be an amazing new kind of currency, right, which could not be overtaken by anybody because it's split between millions of computers all over the world. So nobody has any control over it.
Just decentralized.
Decentralized. So I started to look at it, and we met a miner that my son had met, a crypto miner, Bitcoin miner, young kid, like 20, 21, you know, mining in his bedroom, you know, his garage and so on. So I remember I took some money and an envelope and gave him it in the cafe under the table, just, you know, because I don't want to be out there, you know, just give him the money. And so I'd open an account with Coinbase, and he says, okay, click, click, click. Got your number, your receive wallet for Bitcoin, click, click, click. And we waited. Now, in those days, it took quite a while, you know, but 10, 15 minutes, whoop, in my wallet was my Bitcoin. I thought, this is really cool. So I kept that Bitcoin, and I didn't pay a lot for it because it was 2013. And then over the years, you watch it go, this is interesting. And when it goes up to a couple of thousand, you think, wow, you know. And I kept reading. And then you have to study. So I started reading more and more and more, joining these podcasts and also subscription things, which, you know, people really, really do know about it, where you have to pay for the information. And just kept doing that over the years. I sold a bit to live when I came here to buy a car. But it bought me a car, you know, two cars actually. I bought a little car and a big car. And, you know, Bitcoin's been very good to me. But then you have to start to get really, really into it. and the understanding that the banks don't want it.
Mm.
Like Jamie Dimon, what a guy he is. I mean, he goes out there and says it should be banned. It should be banned. It's a scam. Only drug runners use it. And we found out that in Europe, when he said that, two of his guys were buying Bitcoin.
Well, if bankers are bitching about it, exactly. You know, it must be good. You know.
Well, when he says something, then the price drops. And then they buy.
That's when they buy.
So he's still scamming that, you know, he still hasn't said because they're involved in blockchain technology. They're building their own blockchain technology. The ETS, BlackRock, Grayscale, MicroStrategy, ARK Investments and so on, they put in for ETFs. A lot of people don't understand what those are. Institutions like pension funds and insurance companies cannot buy Bitcoin directly. They're public. You know, they have to have fiduciary duties that don't allow them. They have to go to a fund, right, which is managed. And so BlackRock, Vanguard, ARK, MicroStrategy, they're people that do that. Grayscale is another one. And it were approved, finally. The government in America were trying to stop it and did everything they could, roadblock. Finally, they had to, this last few weeks, it all went ahead. And the money has flowed in like crazy. It's gone up from 54, 53 to 73.
Well, it's hit its all-time high this morning.
That's right.
Wasn't it?
No.
73 this morning?
No, it was, I think it was 69, the all-time high. There's some, you know, argument about what it is.
No, sorry, because
sometimes it goes like that, you know.
Yeah, but wasn't it didn't it hit 72 yesterday and it was 73 today?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a new all-time high.
A new all-time high, you know, from, it was 69 in the, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
So I ignored crypto for a long time, right? It was just something that was a noise in the back of my head, and you'd hear people talking about it, and you'd hear people talking about Bitcoin, and you'd hear stories about that guy who bought pizza for it, right? Which now, if he would have kept hold of that Bitcoin, would have been worth $280 million.
Incredible.
And he bought two pizzas with it back in the day.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but, so it was always a noise in the background for me, and it was never something I really paid much attention to, or it wasn't so much that. It was like, how do I get into it? Because this is something that feels like it's arcane, it's cryptography, all that stuff. So I generally avoided it. And then it was during COVID, 2020, more time on my hands than I, you know, wanted. And I stumbled across Michael Saylor of MicroStrategy.
Yeah.
The best for me guy who's presented the whole argument of why you should buy it, what it means. It's buying digital real estate that you can pass on to your family. You should never sell Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And his command of the subject, his persuasive personality, caused me to go on a Bitcoin spree. I started buying up some Bitcoin and stuff. And I've just sat on it since.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't done anything else.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get into any other types of Bitcoin. I think I'd probably call myself a Bitcoin maximalist.
Well, you know,
and a hodler.
There are other tokens.
Yeah.
And they're also people. That's what people don't understand. They're systems.
Mm.
So it's not, people think you're buying coins and you're gambling on coins.
Yeah.
And it's not really like that. Ethereum is a smart contract system whereby you can have IOU 100 million from a country or a company or 10 million or whatever it is, and I can pay you through Ethereum, right? There's a smart contract attached to that deal, so it goes, and unless that deal is, it's held within the blockchain. In other words, it's a very trusted way of transferring money.
Mm.
And Michael Saylor has just done a little talk this last few days. It was amazing. And I wish everybody could watch that.
Well, maybe you can send us the link and I'll put it in the description of this video.
Because he just tells you what it is. It's the most solid asset ever invented.
It's the way he explained inflation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the way he explained inflation. Yeah. It's not just monetary inflation, it's asset inflation as well. That, for me, just sold me the project, and that's why I bought it, because of him. And what was interesting, though, is that because I was only new to crypto, as it were, I then had to experience my first bear market.
Right.
Right. Which, at first, you're pulling your hair out, you drop down to something like 12,000 a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right? And now it's come back.
Yeah.
Right. And people like Michael Saylor, you've just mentioned, he spent billions of his own cash into his business. Now, when he has to go through that bear market and value of his company is getting slashed because it's tumbling down, and now he must have a smile on his face as big as yours, or maybe a bit bigger.
He's very clever because he buys.
But why do you think it happens? Why do you think there's a cycle like this, that it goes from crazy bull runs in which the price just skyrockets, like we're seeing now with the all-time high, and then it'll go into a bear cycle in which, you know, the value falls out of it?
What's going on? Very basically, this is my understanding of it. You've got day traders involved. Yeah. Day traders will bet on the price, and they're leveraging themselves as well. So in other words, they'll say, we'll bet 2 times the money, 3 times the money, 10 times the money, 20 times the money. It's going to go up to this price within a certain time. If it does, they make money. But they're not buying Bitcoin. If it drops, they can still bet on the price dropping.
Yeah.
And what happens, they get liquidated. If it doesn't do what they say, they get liquidated and they'll lose a fortune. And it's a mug's game. Mm. It really is. And they kind of play with the market in such a way that it affects the price. Because, you know, when billions, you know, get wiped out, and they get wiped out, they have to buy the Bitcoin then, right, to pay, right? Or they've got to sell Bitcoin. So these massive, massive big trades are forced to be made.
So then a cycle.
Well, that's just only one aspect. Then you have the politics. Then you've got, you know, Jamie Dimon making his claims. Then you get somebody come out with Gary Gensler. What an idiot he is, you know. I mean, he's trying to stop it and doing everything he can. He used to teach at MIT, was all for Bitcoin, suddenly got into SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, and he's obviously been given a remit to stop it as much as he can.
Mm.
And this, you know, ATF thing had to be done because he was getting grilled in Congress, in these congressional hearings, and it was obvious what he was doing. Now he's doing that with Ether, right? So you've got all the politics going on, and then you've got Binance, and then you've got that idiot, what they call him, Sam Bankman-Fried. What a scam that was. We won't go into that because it's so complex, but he was involved with the Clintons. He was involved with all those dark forces out there. And people,
it was like
think,
a money laundering operation for the Democrats, wasn't it? Like, that's what
unbelievable.
It unbelievable,
It was unbelievable. That affected the market.
Mm.
Then you get Silicon Bank go down and all those kind of things. So what happens is the market's affected. But now the ETFs have brought in big, serious money.
Mm. What's an ETF again, sorry?
An exchange-traded fund.
Okay.
So it's like in the old days, unit trust funds, or it's just a hedge fund, a fund.
Okay.
That people can invest in, and they diversify. They can put the money in all kinds of, you know, blue chip shares, and BlackRock will say, okay, you've got how much in your pension fund? Right, 100 million. Okay, we'll allocate so much to this, so much to high tech companies, so much to biotech companies, so much for commodities. And now they can put a little bit of that portfolio into cryptos, right? So these big institutions, most of them, haven't yet had meetings. They meet with their wealth managers or their managers within their thing to analyze Bitcoin, talk to BlackRock and Grayscale.
I guess they move much slower as well.
Yes,
these big institutions. Yeah, they can't make big decisions quickly.
They might say, well, we'll put, you know, 10, 20 million in and then we'll see how that goes. And then, oh, we like this. We made some money. Okay, we'll put another 50 million in. So the main investments haven't been met coming in. And what's going to happen? It's going to be a spigot that you undo it and boom, the money starts to flood in.
Mm.
You know, and it's flooding in bit by bit now, but I think it will get bigger and bigger. This year, one of the funds have said their estimate for this year, and these are analysts, these are not like just okay, these are big companies, and they analyze everything. Their forecast this year is for 100,000 Bitcoin.
Wow.
And it's now 200.
Yeah.
Just because of what's happened this last few weeks.
So we've got the halving coming, haven't we, down the pipe?
And
I understand that on a very, very primitive level.
Most people don't understand what it means.
Do you know what it
means?
Yes,
exactly.
Can you enlighten my ignorance when it comes to Bitcoin halving?
The number of Bitcoin mined every day, right, by the miners every week is a certain amount because they're working groups, you know, and there's a block completed. These are transactions. When a block is completed, they get paid and a Bitcoin's produced. All right. So as the Bitcoin's been produced, at the moment, it's 900 Bitcoin are being mined every day. That's it. When the halving comes, the difficulty in the computation, the cryptography within the blockchain is more complex. It's designed that way. So in other words, the cryptography that's working gets harder.
Yeah.
And Satoshi wrote in the code, every 4 years, the cryptography gets harder, so you can only mine now half of the Bitcoin per day, okay, as you used to do. So it'll go down to 450 a day.
So there's a scarcity issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, the scarcity issue won't hit till the end of this year.
Will that drive the price up?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So is this bull run preempting somewhat the halving that's coming? Is that people are trying to get in before the halving happens because that's going to send it up even higher?
It's a combination of everything.
Yeah.
The awareness of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Retail buyers like us buying. The institutions buying. The fact that at the end of the year, when people are seeing these figures, 200,000, you know, they go, well, I'm going to buy more. So these are people already in it, and they're putting more and more money from their fund into Bitcoin as well because they realize this is going to happen. So what happens is this. I think it's something like there's 21 million coins only ever going to be mined.
Mm-hmm.
19.5 million have been done. That's it.
So we're almost
there. It's 1.5 million, yeah. But it's going to take another... I don't know.
Because it's halving each time.
I don't know, 50, 100 years. I can't remember.
Because it's because it halves every 4 years.
Halves. It's harder and harder. So the last crypto will be mined in 2100 or something. It's a long time ahead, right? So the thing is that when this happens and the halving happens, it's kind of a... It creates this supply and then suddenly there's 2 million available every day. That's what happens, 2 million every day available. So now there's going to be less and less and less. Those are going to be eaten up by Christmas, right? So where are you going to buy them? Now what happens is when there's no liquid supply because people are holding them, the price will go up.
Mm.
And then people say, I might sell one. And so it creates a selling, it's a buying and selling thing. So the price has to go up because... The value of those coins is treated, you know, in a different way because there's a shortage, and when there's a shortage, the prices go up. It's very simple.
And it's Bitcoin being the daddy of all crypto.
Yeah.
As the price of Bitcoin rises, everything else comes up with it.
Yes, it affects it. Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's the market, and there's interest in. But sometimes Bitcoin goes up, and the other ones stay where they are.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then Bitcoin, you know, falters a little bit and just, you know, that nobody's buying much. It's all settling like this. And then suddenly, oh, the interest goes into the altcoins. Then becomes altcoin season.
Okay.
After the buy. And then the altcoins, some of them, I'd advise people to look at AI.
Yeah.
AI coins because AI is big.
Tau, someone's huge. Recommended.
Tau is a very good project. Coty. There's another project, AIT is another project. And there are quite a few. AI is going to be massive. Whether we like it or not, it's going to be a big thing.
Some days I absolutely despise it and other days I use it. But I want to talk to you about AI in a short while because there's definitely something that we can chat about there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just want to finish up on crypto a little bit further because it's not just the financial benefits that it can give the common man if he's, you know, wise enough to buy Bitcoin or other cryptos. I don't know anything about other cryptos, really. I know a little bit about Bitcoin. And it wasn't only Michael Saylor that gave me the in, but it was also a guy called Saffredine Ammous, wrote The Bitcoin Standard. Have you ever read that book?
No.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. And he gives the wider context of how Bitcoin... crypto and cryptocurrency in general is the solution to the biggest problem we've got, which we touched upon in the beginning of the podcast,
yeah.
which is central banking. Central banking, in which private bankers create currency for nations, lend out an interest, and that's how they have this enormous political, financial, military control of the world, you know? And there's something quite revolutionary about Bitcoin through that lens.
Yeah, yeah.
So not only can you find a way to improve the quality of your own life and your family's, but in some way you can also, it's a way to have a pop at the current system, especially, you know, this central banking system. Is that one of the other things that you find attractive about crypto?
Michael Saylor said something the other day again, which is very important. It's about understanding what Bitcoin is doing for the world. It's not about paying for things. Bitcoin's not really a good platform for paying for things. It's like
store
a commodity store of value.
Yeah.
It's digital gold.
Yeah.
And it's better than gold because you can mine more gold. Bitcoin, you cannot mine anymore. There's only those 21 million, that'll be it. So the price will grow and grow and grow. You can carry a seed phrase in your head and you can carry $1 billion with you to another country.
Or lose it on a boating accident as well if you need to.
I mean, you basically can go anywhere. No, you can't take a building with you. You can't take gold with you. You can't take silver with you. But and commodities, you can take that wealth with you. So that's one reason. The other thing is that it's giving people this freedom of the world. There's so many unbanked people. And underneath this Bitcoin system, all these other protocols are being developed where the systems, people think they're coins, they're not, they're systems. So I've talked about Ether, which is NFTs and so on, where people build on top of their protocol, cryptography system. Energy Web is another one where they're going to get all the energy companies and they'll be, you know, tokenized. So the units will be tokenized. So that value is within the blockchain system. Energy Web. Theta is another one which has to do with video.
Yeah.
Video streaming. So each of these good projects, there's a lot of meme coins, which really are just coins. And so most of those will disappear within the next 5-10 years. So the projects you want to be involved in are things that basically have a use case. A system. So there's one called Chainlink. You go, what's that? It links all the other chains together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to link your Ethereum to this, to this, to this, to this, to the other chains, Chainlink solves that problem.
So it's got a purpose within the cryptocurrency universe.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more it's used, the price goes up.
Mm.
People buy that and they buy into the you know.
So thing how itself. Do you find projects? What's your method?
Well, I've got a couple of things here. There's so many YouTubers, and a lot of them don't know anything really. They study just like us, and they study. All right. So Altcoin Daily, they've got like 2 million viewers. They are very good.
Altcoin Daily.
Altcoin
and
Daily.
This is a YouTube channel.
Yeah, a guy called Aaron, and he's in Dubai. Obviously made a lot of money. They give tips on things. They have people on. They interview people. They're very, very good. The other one's an English one called Coin Bureau. And
yeah, I've seen that
very,
one. Yeah,
very, very good.
Yeah.
Again, he analyzes the papers. So when all this legislation is going on, there's a, you know, 70, 80 page thing on legislation in Europe, you know, to try and control currencies, cryptos. He will read that document and then pick out things and give you the, you know, pertinent points. So he's very good. There's another guy called Plan B.
Mm.
I've just put this as a random one. He's nobody knows who he is.
Mm.
He's called Plan B, and he's got a dark figure. You never see his face.
Didn't he put together like a technical analysis, like at the during the last bull run?
Yeah,
and that's what he became famous for. It was his
because he's a technical analyst. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, for really serious people who want to be in dollar vigilante, they have an Acapulco. In Mexico.
Anarchapulco, it's a good name.
All the anarchists go there, but there he's a really cool guy. But you have to pay really good money to get that subscription. And there's a lot of other stuff he does as well. And then the other one is Future Forecasting Group. And they're a group of remote viewers. Mm. And part of their thing, they have a technical analyst for 30 years who you get his information on crypto. And then you also get the remote viewing. They'll even remote view cryptos.
Well, I've had some of the most famous remote viewers on this podcast, so we know it works. I know the American CIA used it for long periods, but I always thought it'd be quite an interesting use case of remote viewing is to try and figure out what cryptos to buy. Is that what they do on that channel?
They do all kinds of things. They get blind, you know, that's how it works. They have a number. Mm. You know, X3245. That's all they get. And they'll close their eyes, go into this little, and they start to draw, right? And they record it. Mm. And then they put all, there's about five of them do the same thing. And it's uncanny, the things that they forecast. Now, Dick Allgaier, who was a TV personality in Hawaii.
He sent me some of his links. Yeah, he's really one of the, good.
Yeah, and he's a... He does. The podcast is kind of lighthearted most of the time, but behind it's very serious. But he's very, very good. So when he was training, they do these things where they just draw things like this. He went back and he found his drawings in 2000, two buildings with planes crashing into them. And he'd forgotten about it because it was done when he was training. And he went back and saw his own drawings. Bloody hell. He foresaw 9/11.
Well, there's something much deeper in the whole idea of remote viewing things like crypto and September 11. Because I remember a quote by J.P. Morgan. And I'm paraphrasing here, but it was along the lines of... good investors use charts and analysis. The best investors use astrologists. I'd say astrology is kind of similar to remote viewing in the sense that you're tapping into another part of the matrix, the simulation. You're tapping into another part of it where time doesn't exist. So therefore you can see in the future, you can see into the past.
Yeah.
It's all one.
Yeah.
Right. And I always thought that would be a good use case of trying to, you know, leverage some of that information, especially when people like JP Morgan, all the top guys, they all use astrologists. And you think, because the way astrology is sold to us is that it's, you know, it's just some silly thing that you can work out your horoscopes and stuff. But they take it really, really serious. In the 90s, my mother had her own astrologist and she used to get her charts done. I used to go, how does he earn his money, this guy? Yeah. And she went, he does charts for all of the big corporations.
Right.
The big corporations would hire him to do an astrology chart.
Oh,
and that's when I realized, I thought, there must be something in it.
Kings and generals.
These people wouldn't waste money on astrologists if they didn't know something that we don't.
Kings were going to battle. The astrologer was there to look at things and in the card readers and so on. Just something I just remembered. Michael Saylor made a very, very important point in this thing, this talk he gave yesterday. I think it was yesterday. You want to get involved in a subject. Now, Bitcoin and cryptos and money is a serious subject. So
vast, bottomless pit.
People want to, can you come and open it, help me open an account? I've never done that. I said, I'll send you lots of information and then you can ask me questions. But you've got to understand it. So Michael Saylor said, listen, if you want to get involved in something like this and you're really, really serious about it, you've got to do at least 100 hours. Mm. If you don't do 100 hours... you don't know anything really about the subject. If you're serious about something, do it, because otherwise, don't do it.
Don't waste my time.
And don't waste it, because basically what you're doing is you don't understand it. Mm. And it takes a lot. I've spent 10 years and I still know very little. I don't know the technicalities. I don't want to, basically.
I want to
understand the concept of it, of where if I wanted to pay you for something now and you have a crypto wallet, I can just go click, 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 and pay you.
Mm.
And you've got it within a few seconds. And it doesn't go through a bank. And that's the key to it. That's what this cryptocurrency is all about, being able to pay for things. So at the moment, the only way you can really, really do it, unless you've got a wallet, you can pay for things through your Visa and you take it, sell the crypto, put it on your Visa, and you can do it with, mm-hmm. within an app. But that's really not what it's about. It's about having a system where cryptos are accepted by shops and for goods and services. Once that starts to happen, there'll be a flood and everybody will have all these different cryptocurrencies depending on what they like. And you've got to pay in, you know, what do you want? Do you want Chainlink? Do you want, you know, Ether? What do you want? Now, the idea is the fees, and this is the key to all this. The fees for banking are enormous. They make billions and billions and billions from fees. So if I am a company and I want to transfer this money across the world, say it's 100 million, I don't know what the fee is. They might pay 5 million or 20 million to move the money. It might be 3%, 2 or 3%. You're thinking, bloody hell. So all these people moving money around, the banks make billions. So if a company want to use, you know, they've got into crypto and they won't use Bitcoin probably, they'll use something like XRP. I believe that's going to be the one for banks. But let's say it's XRP. So they say, okay, we convert what we want to send into XRP. Click a button. They've got it instantly across the world. How much? A couple of dollars instead of 5-10 million. So you think of the implications of that. That's the banking system has inserted itself into society in such a way that we can't do anything without them. That's why they control everything. And there's these famous quotes like, control the money supply and you control the governments. You control the world. You control everything. The Babylonian money magic system has been running for many, 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 many hundreds of years, hundreds, maybe a thousand years. And it's still operating now, and it's collapsing because this system is coming in and it will replace it. How it'll work, I don't know, because the banks are creating these CBDCs, and you must stay away from those. Just look at China, the credit system, that's how it works. Basically, if you...
It's telling you what you can spend, isn't it?
They say to you, well, you've not done this, you've done something badly, they took your score down, you go to work one day and they won't let you on the bus.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Well, I've seen quite a few videos from China, and who knows what's true, but how they use this whole credit system, credit score system, and how, you know, they can tell you what you can spend on your CBDC.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the way that we want to go, and we have to do what we can to push back against such a dystopian system that they're trying to foist upon us. But let's stay positive because we're in a bull run.
Oh, yeah.
So where do you think this bull run is heading? Where do you think we're going with this particular phase that we're going through now? Is it going to be short-lived? Is it going to go on and on and on? What are your best guesstimates on what's happening right now with this bull run?
I think it's going to keep going. But what happens is that when you get a nice little run, so it's gone to 73 today. Say it goes up now to 75, 76. It goes up in stages. There are those people who want to take a profit. So they'll sell a lot, brings the price down, and it could drop to 68. It could drop to 72, 69, drop quite a lot, right? And there's those traders who are betting on the price going down because they think, people are going to start selling soon. Okay, I bet the price is going to go to 69.
Right, okay.
And if it goes to 69 and they put a 10 thing leverage on it, they make a fortune, right? And they lose a fortune if it doesn't. Right. So they're guessing.
Yeah.
They're gamblers, basically. Yeah. So basically,
high stakes, rollers.
It's going to go up and then back down. Then it'll go up and then back down. Then up. It's going to keep going up, but there'll be these corrections. There might be a period where people go nuts and they buy more and more and more, and the price goes so high, it's really beyond what it should be. There'll be a correction, and it will drop back, and it could drop back 10,000, 20,000.
Yeah.
Right?
And it always seems to go up, doesn't it, over a period?
Yeah, but people say, you know, Bitcoin's, you know, collapsing. No, it isn't. It's just corrections in the market. And because it's a volatile asset, because people are just beginning to understand it, we're still at the beginning of 10 years. Now the next phase is the beginning of the next 5 years will be understanding it. And then the price will probably next year will probably be 500,000. by next year.
What, Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think, you know, conservatively,
I'm still conservative.
I think, you know, 250,000 conservative, but I think it could reach 500,000 next year.
Wow.
Then it could correct.
Yeah.
A lot of people will say, I'm going to buy a house.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy a car. It's a big sell-off. And the people, there's plenty of people there to buy. The institutions will be buying like crazy, right?
So that's the thing, isn't it? At the moment, is like people who haven't come into Bitcoin and they're watching on the outside and they're seeing the price go through the roof and they're thinking, I've missed this. And therefore, they won't purchase any because they think it's too high, right? And then they miss out again on an opportunity, which is a year down the line, like you say, it could be worth half a million. If somebody is watching this podcast and they're chomping at the bit to get into Bitcoin, what would they do? Would you say now is the time to buy?
I was telling people to buy when it was like 42, and I said, get in now while the price is like, oh, it just collapses. That was the time to get in because it was 67. So the next run, it's going to be 70, 80.
Mm.
Right? You buy now, whatever. Now, what they do is they wait and wait and wait.
Yeah.
It starts to go up and it gets to 60, 73 and they go, oh, I missed out. Let's buy some. And you're oh, God, you know, you're buying at the wrong time. But in a way, Michael Saylor again says it, there's never really a wrong time.
No.
He says, a lot of these institutions will just keep buying.
Because that's exactly what happened with me, right? When I first discovered, when it was my time to buy Bitcoin, it was thanks to Michael Saylor saying, look, it doesn't matter where it is because it's still really, really early.
Yeah.
Right. So even though it might be 30,000 now and it was 15,000 6 months ago and you're thinking, oh God, I can't buy now. He's going, no, it's still really, really, really early. Get in. It doesn't matter where it is right now in that part of the run.
Yeah.
It's only going to keep going up and up and up over the long term.
It's still good. Although there is another way to do it, which is more difficult, but you've got to study.
Mm.
It's the altcoins.
Okay.
So I won't go into too much detail, but I met this really nice guy here and I went for breakfast with him. He was telling me his story. So he had some shares and they were worth very little. And suddenly that week they went up to 100 grand and he went, wow. Now, his friend had told him about VeChain, and he didn't know much about cryptos. He said, well, that money, I didn't expect to have it. So I thought, I'll put 100 grand into VeChain. Great.
Roll of the dice.
He looked in his wallet a little while later, and he had 2 million.
Wow.
So, and that's a true story, because I know the guy. So the thing is, some of these altcoins
can explode.
Can really explode 100 times, because they're projects that are just... they've been going for a long, 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 long time. And suddenly they start to work and people are using them and the price just goes sky high, you know, and people get into that and the money flows in. And one of the things I advise people, if you make that kind of money very quickly, take a bit, leave the money in, maybe you put in, and then take some profit. And so you're enjoying life. You're not just constantly looking at the, you know, the price is going on. No, take some money, enjoy. That's what I do.
Good. Yeah.
I take a little bit out, you know.
Okay, well, hopefully next time we speak on this podcast, we'll be talking about Bitcoin price at 250 grand.
Yeah, that's what we hope.
So we were chatting the other day as well about AI.
Yep.
And for me, at the moment, I'm struggling with the whole concept of AI. I think on some respects, it's an incredible achievement of humanity, where we're up to with this level of sophistication with the machines that we're building and we're creating. But on the flip side of that coin, it's horrific as well. One of the main things that's triggered in me has been because of Sora, which is OpenAI's new model, which is video, right? And the clip that they dropped, which was about, I think about a month ago, they dropped a clip of how realistic this video is going to become. And it all comes from a text prompt.
Yeah.
And they can put a text prompt in and next thing you know, you've got this photorealistic video, right, of what's in the text. Now, that's just right now. Now, where that leads to, it's just quite dystopian in my view. And if, you know, it ends tons of people's livelihoods. Cameras might even become obsolete. And it was one of those things. And we were chatting about it briefly. And you were telling me your story of
your understanding of AI, first of all, because you work in licensing art, you know, and you've been doing that for a long time, but also your knowledge of stock images, and this whole field is, you know, where you've cut your teeth, where you've built your business, and you've got a really, really insightful understanding of the whole route of where it's come from and where it's going. Tell us what you think about where we're at and how you arrived there.
Well, give you a little backstory to give you context is that I think it was 73, I set up a stock library with a partner.
Yeah, didn't you have an agency in 1969?
I had a model agency for a few years. And then in 73, I had a disc jockey school. I had.
But in 1969, kind of, that's 69. Like the height of the whole rock and roll revolution, isn't it?
People look at me and they're like, what? You were living then? You were how old are you?
Not just living, you know, at the heart of the whole thing.
Oh, I was at the heart of it. It was incredible, you know. I was meeting people like Georgie Best, and I had Mike Summerby, who wanted to be a model. He came to my agency and all that.
This was in Manchester?
Yeah, all in Manchester, you know, so, which was the best place to be, apart from London, but I prefer Manchester. So anyway, we set up a stock photo library, and I learned a lot from that. So 79, I thought,
mean, that must have been one of the earliest stock libraries around at the time.
No, not really. There were a few in London, and they've been going quite a few years, some from the newspapers, like Rex Features, where all the pictures they took for the newspaper would go in the library. So they've been doing pictures for many, many, many years.
So that's how newspapers would make a little bit of extra cash, would they? They would resell.
Syndicate the pictures, you know, to other people pictures. And sell them for, you know, whatever. And then you've got libraries that did set up and photographers shooting London Bridge, you know, going to Paris and doing the Eiffel Tower, going out on an oil rig at sea and taking pictures. Because if you want a picture quickly of an oil rig at sea in a storm, think of how much that's going to cost.
And that would be their specific job, is to go out and get stock footage for the library. Yeah.
Stock footage, you see. Yeah. So I met all these people because I was in the committee for a while, the British Association of Picture Libraries. But basically, I set up the library, and then I thought, I was talking to a client, and he said, nobody's doing this for artists. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So long story short, I sold my shares in the company Photo Library, and I set up an art agency. And that's really where I've been, you know, for over 40 years. And our photographers and our artists produce art, which we license, which means we get a contract and they want to print it as a canvas, a poster, a greetings card, a jigsaw puzzle.
Is this where your relationship with Athena was developed?
So I was basically one of their main suppliers of art, and they paid me a lot because, you know, I supplied a lot. Mm. And it's 50-50. That's in our industry, 50-50. I mean, I have like 25% expenses out of that, running a company and people and so on, you know, which I got bigger and bigger and so on. But that's too long a story. It's really when the AI came out, I read all the, you know, people worried, all the artists, oh my God, we're going to lose
that. Because that must have directly affected your business. In terms of enough for you to go and find out what this means.
It made me think. Yeah. I'm thinking, how is it going to affect our business, right? Because nobody was producing art yet, but they were playing around with it, with Mid Journey and Night Cafe and so on. And I thought, well, I'm going to look at this. So I did a lot of videos of photographers and people. And this one guy is an artist. And he said, I've looked at this. And he said, it's amazing. Now, I'm an artist. I love to paint. So I'm thinking, you know, all these artists are going to say, oh, this is horrible. I mean, you know, you're going to be digitally produced by AI and artists are going to disappear. He said, and then I looked at it and he thought, well, this is here. It ain't going to go away. So why not look at it and embrace it? And that was my opinion as well, embrace it. So I wrote a note to all my artists and saying, look at AI. Photoshop have got this thing where you've got an image like this, right? And it's a picture of a street scene and it's got a sign, no entry sign. It's ruining the picture, right? He's got this, click a button and it's gone. And it fills it in for you automatically. That's a use of AI. Then we started to look at Midjourney and Night Cafe, where through prompts, and you can put a picture in, and the picture is a guide. This is the kind of thing we're looking for. So it immediately searches for all images like that, and you've typed in a thing. So I want a boat, one old boat, rowing boat on a beach with the beach shack in behind, few seagulls, blue sky, colours very pale, in the style of watercolour. A minute later, you've got a picture.
So how does AI come up with that picture? Because it's not creating anything original, is it?
Mm-hmm.
It's using, it's derivative in a sense.
That it
is. It's using its search of the internet.
Yeah, there's a bit, this is very controversial.
Yeah. Right?
There's a thing, I can't remember the name of it. It's a Institute of Digital Technology Institute, something that look into these things for ethics and so on. And I read their piece on it. And by all accounts, this is what happens. AI scans everywhere, all, you know, and it's got scraping.
So you put in a fox, right? Yeah. And it'll go and look at every image of the fox on the internet.
You'll just write down,
yeah,
fox in snow.
Yeah.
Snow scene, right? So it will scan and find foxes. Now, that people have this idea that it's stealing pictures. It isn't.
Mm.
And I've read a lot about this. It scrapes little bits. Now, when you do a digital image, it's like, say it's 10,000 pixels by 10,000 pixels.
Yeah.
It will take 100 pixels from that and 100 pixels from that, 100 pixels from that. So in other words, it composites from thousands of pictures.
What did he say? One source is plagiarism, three sources is research.
Yes, exactly. But this is hundreds and hundreds of sources to create a new picture.
Yeah.
So it is original in the sense that it's a new picture, but it's been, so you can't copyright it because you've not created it yourself by hand, right? Now, if you were...
So you can't copyright AI art?
No, you can't. Wow. Now, if you were an artist and you took a picture and then you got some art and you scan the art and you scan the thing and you did together and you did some with Painter, software, you'll go into it like this and you're creating some art, mixed media. You can copyright that.
Mm.
AI creates the art, so you can't copyright it.
How can you license the what you create in the AI?
Because it's a new piece.
But aren't you, how you can't copyright it?
No, doesn't matter. Client just prints it.
I see, yeah.
You just print it because it's a new piece.
Mm.
And it's not protected by copyright. It changes everything. As I say, I'll just segue back.
Yeah.
Slightly tangent. When the photo libraries, they were very big, and we'd get an order and it'd say, we want this image of an oil rig at sea. We're going to use it on a 48 sheet poster for an advert. And we say, okay, how many are you going to print? Okay, 10,000 or 5,000 or 2,000. Be a lot of money, depending on how big the campaign was. So the idea of images is you pay according to the usage, what benefit you get from that image, we want paying for, part of it, right? So I'll overcharge you. It's a front cover of a brochure and you're printing 10,000 copies, which say it's going to cost you a couple of hundred. You want to print 500,000 copies, we charge you 500 because you're getting more benefit. So it was very fair, right? But along came Corbis, which is Microsoft, Getty, Getty family.
Yeah.
And they decided to buy up all the photo libraries.
When was this?
It was started in the, I think, 80s, 90s, 80s and 80s and 90s.
So they started to buy up the photo libraries.
Yeah.
Do you think they did that knowing what was coming down the line and they were trying to buy them cheap and have control over a monopoly over stock images online?
I didn't know at the time.
But now looking back?
Now looking back, I think there's far more, to that because copyright then is that we've been trying to get copyright, how can I put it, sort of dilute copyright. In some ways, it's been there, but you can't put your fingers on it specifically. But copyright's been sort of played around with, and I think free use of images, when you go free use, you think, well, wait a minute, who's making money out of this? So they have millions and millions of images. At the end of the year, they make a lot of money. But the photographer who took it, that puts his thing in, unless he's producing 1,000 pieces a year, volume, you know, shoveling stuff in there. It's like shoveling art. Instead of creating a great piece of art and you get 500 for it, yeah, well, you get five for use on this product, which is 200 years ago. So it's diluted that. It's destroying the incomes of photographers, destroying the incomes of artists, because they used to ring up and book a picture, you know, and they'll say, we want to.
So this has been as a direct result of Corbis and Getty buying everything up.
Yeah.
They have devalued the price of the art and photographs that are online.
But now they're getting their comeuppance, I believe.
Okay.
Because AI means that we can create anything we want quickly. So you imagine you're an artist.
Okay,
now.
So that's an interesting way of putting it. So you're seeing it more as the democratization of creativity rather than the monopolization through...
There's a good side to it. Okay. No, you're an artist and you're struggling and you're doing paintings and they take you 3 days to do one. Now you can create 20 pieces in a day. You can make money again, you know. You can print them, you know, sell the prints, right? But you're not spending all this time. So my artists were taking a week to do one piece. Those people, obviously,
out of isn't the value in scarcity? Whereas, so if one artist, then again, there has to be a demand for that artist, doesn't there?
Yeah.
You have to create that demand either through marketing or through other clever means. But if that artist can only produce 10 works a year, then there's a demand for those 10 works. But if they're now producing 1,000 works a year,
right?
Does the value of the artist come down, or do you have an opportunity to sell more art? I don't know. Right.
I'll give you a like future thing, future forecasting, you know, my prediction, my thing. So the artists now that producing AI will stay alive and make a little bit of money from it. And it sort of helps to democratize it a little bit, so they don't have to work hard. And the artists will realize less and less and less that it's becoming a problem, right? And so it will be a dearth of AI art out on the market. And you can't tell the difference. Some of it's amazing. You can do things with AI you can't do with painting. You know, can't do it. And it's amazing, beautiful, absolutely stunning artwork, right? But... you know, if you're a true connoisseur of art, you would look at the art and, you know, the aesthetic people, you know, in the big, you know, like Tate Modern would frown on this and say, it's not a shit, you know. What happens is that you look at it and you haven't got that, because it's not original.
Yeah.
You don't get that feeling from it.
But there's no human has been through any suffering in order to create the work.
So it's a phase, right? So I'll forecast probably in 2030 and onwards, people will start to say, I want some real art. And be all those people,
I agree with you.
That will still stay in that camp, right? But artists will become rarer and rarer. And so real artwork will then start to be in demand again, and it'll come full circle, and then the artist will start to do well again.
I think I agree with you on this because, you know, I've been looking at this Sora, which creates these photorealistic video images, and I'm thinking, okay, well, let's say in 10 years' time, in 15 years' time, where that video that's being created by AI is so advanced and so good, it kind of makes obsolete people with cameras or actors what happens then, right?
You can now put Tom Cruise in a movie. It's not Tom Cruise. Yeah,
Tom Cruise has a... So how does he then license... I mean, what is Tom Cruise then, you know?
I know.
There's so many things that come as a result at what point do we then reject or even know? But at what point do we reject art that's made by a robot? Do we have any emotional connection to art made by a robot?
Yeah.
And if we don't, then does it have any value?
Yeah.
Right? Because if it doesn't have any value, then what is it? And then, like you say, is that it'll go full circle once the novelty is over.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Then we want...
It's disruptive technology.
Disruptive technology. Because I went to... I said this in the last podcast, but I think it's relevant to this one, is that I went to a house party
in Lagos during Christmas, and there was the families were there, the kids were there. I went looking for Donnie in one of the rooms, and the kids were in one of the bedrooms, and they were in there all around a vinyl deck playing vinyl records.
All right.
They were buying them, they were trading them. I was what?
Incredible.
So it was almost a rejection of the streaming thing, even though they'll still listen to the streaming for something tangible, real, and still created.
It becomes nostalgia, you see.
Yeah.
And when nostalgia, people go, they get bored with it. But remember, do you remember when the internet, I was involved with the computers right at the beginning. Mm. We had a computer in 1976.
Mm. A year
big
was born.
Bloody box, and you're typing in code and everything else. And we foresaw the digital age then, before anybody else in the library business. So when I set up my company in 79, I put computers in all around the building. I had 10 computers and everybody working, and we did barcoding artwork and things like that.
Wow.
And so we were very advanced in what we did. When CDs, I said, right, we'll put the artwork in a CD. You have to send it in the, big chunks of artwork.
I'm a technologist.
I'd send it down to people. And I was 5 years too early.
Yeah.
Because I went to New York to a big show, and a guy walked past, our booth, and he sees this screen. And I'm playing, artwork. He says, what? He said, I've just done a lecture on the future. He said, on how CDs are going to change the world. He said, you've already got it. He says, you should have been with my lecture.
Mm.
And what had happened is that I'd seen it, because I'd been thinking about this for a long time. We sent the CD, and they found out that the big companies only had like three computers, one in the accounts department, another one in this department, another in that department. And basically, the creative director had to go with the CD and try and get the accountant a little bit to plug it in. It didn't work until they all had computers.
Well, I was the same. I've had a computer since I was, as young as I can remember. I had the Spectrum 48K. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
With the rubber buttons, and the Atari ST, Pong, had them all the way through. And, I'm a technologist. I love technology and I love cameras and I love, gadgets, and I'm into it. But what's interesting is when you talk about CDs and the amount of research and development that must have went into creating CDs, hundreds of millions of dollars must have went into creating CDs, but now they're obsolete. Who uses CDs?
They
come
CDs,
and they went,
You upgrade your computer and you got your new laptop and you go, wait a minute, where's the CD slot? And it suddenly disappeared.
That was
how they did it.
But it's crazy, isn't it? It's like, is how quickly something can emerge into the market, some new piece of tech.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And everyone goes crazy for it.
Yeah.
And then as quick as it arrived, it disappears as they move to the to the next phase. And I think that's where we're at right now with AI. It's this new emergent technology that is totally different than anything else that we've ever experienced. This is like a whole new phase of our consciousness and where we're heading. And I don't know if the future that AI presents is dystopian. It feels like it could be. It feels like, one of the things that separates us from the animals is the fact that we can appreciate and create art, right? Which is this abstract idea of our understanding of this experience on this mortal coil, of this simulation, isn't it? It's how we interpret the simulation is through our ability to express art. But it feels as if once the robots do that, well, what else is left for us to do to be original and unique about?
I watch a lot of science fiction, and in many cases, this is another subject for another day, but the dark forces and the light, the forces of light and the forces of dark, they're in every Marvel movie, every DC comics, every, sort of movie that seems to be made now has some element of the dark force. And it's always defeated. And I heard many years ago that the law of the universe is that the dark forces, who are necessary as a catalyst to create more good, so they've got to be really evil. And it's quite complex how it works, but that seems to be how it works. So I saw this movie, or section of the movie, which was done in 1968. I think I've sent it to you. You may not have seen it yet. Donald Pleasance and this other guy. It's a 20-minute clip from the movie. Can't remember the name of the movie. 1968. And Donald Pleasance is some government guy in an office somewhere, and he invites this man in, and he says, we like your intellect. And he says, you know, we know about you. Well, how do you know about me? He says, well, when you went for your appendix, see this little thing? It's like a little, you know, capsule. He said, we put a chip in you. And so we've been monitoring you. I mean, not only is, you know, your heartbeat, your conversations. He said, we know when you left, you had an affair. He was, what? And basically they want to coerce him into working for them because he has a great brain. And that's the idea.
Mm.
And at the end, this long clip, he says, I really don't want to do this. He said, you start on Monday. And he said, what if I don't? He says, well, the chip that's in you, we can just basically, you're dead. That was it.
Mm.
1968. Now, this Harari guy that's come out, you know, this Economic Forum guy, and if you watch his speeches, his talks, these people are psychopaths. 100%. They basically want to chip you and control you. And he said, this really shocked me, biological life is over. And you go, let that sink in. But this is what scares me more. It's not that. It's the people. I said to someone when I was in England, I said, do you know the World Economic Forum? No, what's that? I said, that's the think tank, which is run by, I believe, a Nazi. And his father was a Nazi. And he has Nazi tendencies where he wants to eliminate lots of people on this planet. And they've created all these ideas that their world leaders come and these industry guys come, leaders of industry, and they purport to help the world by controlling it and designing the world as they think it should be, this small elite group of people. Now, I think that people out there should know about that because these are the plans that they put in place many, many, many years ago, and now they're starting to push them. I've heard there's a meat factory has been told in America they have to grow insects, I mean farm insects instead. Been told the farms are being decimated and so on and so forth. So there's a plan afoot. I know we're going off topic, but he said, that's the plan for the world that's going on. So going back to AI, AI is very scary. Elon Musk has said that. He said, unless it's controlled properly, and there are restrictions in place to certain restrictions, it could get out of hand.
Well, I don't think it can be controlled properly because the people in control are the ones that, you know, should be sent to prison,
yeah.
Right? You know,
some of them, yeah.
Some of them, right. But there's
some good guys and some bad guys, again. Yeah,
but the ones that we get to see, the ones that, you know, were responsible for what we've seen over the last few years, you know, and those are the guys that are pushing it. The bankers, the ones who have created this centrally controlled interest-based debt enslavement system are the ones who are behind, you know, who are pushing AI, who are investing all the money into it, the hundreds of billions of dollars. So I wouldn't trust them as far as I could spit, you know. So that's the problem, is that unless we have some divine intervention in whatever shape that may come, whether that's Bitcoin, right, whether Bitcoin is the divine intervention that can help us break free of the chains and shackles of this dystopian simulation that is being threatened.
It's a part of it. There's a bigger picture that is, most people would never get this to start with. It takes a lot of study because I've gone through 30, 40 years of trying to understand the world we live in and how it works and the divine aspect of it. You know, the creator. I don't believe in a God with a big beard. And, you know, I believe in it. It's a creative principle. Mm-hmm. It's the creator, the creative principle, intelligence.
It's above and beyond our comprehension.
And anybody can look at a flower, look at a human being and see the intelligence. It's architected. I mean, it's really the greatest architects that we can't imagine. You think of a human body and how it works, and it works, you know, very well. So this is what I've come to the conclusion, that we are in a simulation. And in a simulation, things are already kind of planned out in a sense. The free will thing comes in. That's another argument which you can go round and round in circles. But basically, we do have free will on a day-to-day basis with things we do. But overall, these things are planned.
Mm.
If that film in 1968 was talking about chips, which weren't invented then, you realise that these plans are in place.
Mm.
But who is planning?
Mm.
And you see the madness going on.
Because some of the plans are over such a long period of time that those making the plans wouldn't even be around to see the fruition of them. All their sons. Yes. And you think, why would you do that over such a long range of time?
Totally.
You
know? Because they're not making the decisions.
No.
I think they make certain decisions, but there's a hierarchy above the humans.
Mm.
Again, that's very deep, and a lot of people would not even look at that. They say, go away. They say to me, you know, I don't want to know about that. But there's another level, and it's a kind of a...
We'll talk about anything on this podcast. You're okay, you're in good company.
It's another level. So this is what I've heard, a really good note, is that there will be... There's been forecast for many years.
Mm-hmm.
I did 100 hours of video with a guy called Corey Good and David Wilcock. They did Gaia TV. And some people have said poo-pooed it and all the rest. They always do that. But there's The Law of One, which is a book which was channeled, because I'll go into channeling a long, long, long time ago. And what the channels are saying and the books are saying is that the world will go crazy, go mad, which it's going to. One of my teachers told me that. He said, the world's collapsing. It's like all these layers, all these worlds are all collapsing. And there'll be two timelines. And suddenly, something will happen, like a solar flash. They say it could be the polar shift or a combination, some kind
cataclysm.
Of cataclysm. But it will be that those that have a loving heart, to me, you have to be loving, kind, compassionate, and giving, forgiving, and practice that every day of your life. And we will be on a different timeline.
Mm.
Because you look at some of the things that people are saying and doing now, destroying the family and the way they live, without getting to any specifics, you look at the world and it's crazy, right? So I believe the timelines will split. And they're saying it's going to happen between now and 2030, which is why 2030, I believe, is the key that they've been using, that by 2030, they've got to solve all these problems,
which
are the dark forces, right? The deep state, if you like. They want to control this, the narrative, because we're going to move.
Well, that is actually true, is that they are working to a 2030 timeline, which is the sustainable goals with the UN, and they brought it forward. It was 2050, wasn't it, originally? Yeah. But they're working to a strict timeline for some reason. You know, why are they working to a strict timeline?
Because, basically, the world is waking up.
Yeah.
And the more awake we get, basically, the balance of the whole world population, it's like a... It's a universal mind, and universal mind is there, and we tap into that. And basically, the more and more enlightened that becomes, the more loving it becomes, because I believe that's the fabric of the universe is love. So the fabric of the universe basically is changing, and the balance, the more it goes up like this, the more they're trying to stop it.
To race against time.
And they try to basically create a war or create this because they want to distractions. And they want to create fear. And fear is what these people live off.
Mm.
So, again, it gets a bit deep, but the higher dimensions, right, that I believe are in charge of this, through the proxies of the bankers and the proxies of the Rothschilds and the Rockefeller types and, you know, George Soros and those people, it's like they've been used by some kind of unseen power. Let's call it an unseen power. And that unseen power... It's been controlling this planet for a long, long, long time, and it's losing its grip. And the angelic realms, right, they're working for us, and lifting us up. And that's why we've got to, that's why so much is about yoga and meditation and mindfulness. And if we do that, we create a loving environment. The fear's not there. These people, you know, they've nothing to feed off.
Okay, what a great way to finish the podcast on such a beautiful, positive note. It's a great counterbalance to some of the dark energies that are trying to drag us down and trying to make us fear the future. But before we do wrap it up, I know you're kind of like famous for your being 5 years ahead of the curve. Right, so what are you predicting 5 years down the line? What kind of early bets can I get in on here, Michael, before it comes to fruition? Where are you placing your dollars? So what cryptos? Because we talked about AI, and you mentioned one of the ways we segued into AI was that you said one of the good tokens and cryptos to get in on is AI at the moment. To finish up on this podcast,
all right,
tell us a little bit about what cryptos you recommend from the AI world.
I think that people should study before they buy anything. Understand it. It's very important to understand it. Don't just go buy cryptos. I've got people ringing me, how do I get my cryptos off my exchange? You know, how do I get them into my bank account? How do I sell them? Don't do it if you don't know that to start with, right? So the AI tokens, there's AIT.
AIT.
There's Palm. I'm not sure Coatis. I think Coatis part of that, but it's a very good coin. Those are the ones that I believe will be, you know, very strong projects. I don't go for lots of them. I only choose one or two. And I look at them, look at the projects, look at the people investing in them and say, okay, so those are good projects. XRP, I think it's going to be the banker's coin.
Do we not want to avoid the banker's coin?
Yes, I avoided it for years.
Yeah.
But now I believe that basically the banks need something to transmit money between countries. It's still needed. There's a kind of banking's needed, right? So therefore that coin, I think, will be very big. So it's a pure investment. You buy some XRP and Stellar, XLM, which I believe is going to be the one of the coins that's going to be used on your
silver, digital pole. Silver.
Yeah. XLM, XRP, and then Bitcoin and Ether. That's it. Okay. If you stick to those, you can't really go wrong. You know, if they went, everything's gone. You know what I mean? It's really
that's the foundation.
Yeah, the foundation. You look at the market cap, which is the market capitalization of the tokens, and you'll see how big they are. And then occasionally, if you want to gamble and you hear about something, just put 50 or 100 bucks in that. And if you lose it, you don't care.
Yeah.
But sometimes some of those, like SHIB,
like 2 whatever, million.
Went up. And yeah, 2 million.
You know, the guy you told us about before, you know, he put 100 grand in, was it? And he got 2 million from it. Cool. Okay, really, really enjoyed that conversation. If people want to find you, connect with you, reach out to you, email you, anything like that, have you got any places for them to do so?
No.
Okay.
I'm a very private guy.
Okay.
And I keep myself to myself. If I come across people in the street or I meet them in a cafe and I think they're asking the right questions, I'm not an elitist, don't get that wrong, but I want people who really understand it. And I'd say to them, go read this, go read that. I'll give them things to read. I have a thing that I send to people, friends, and I say, read those, do that, then come back and ask questions. And I'll tell you something, when I arrived here, and you won't believe this, because I didn't. I'd done reasonably well, right, on cryptos. And I was trying to teach people about it. So I'd say, you know, study it. This is the information. I said, go open an account with Coinbase and I will send you 100 euros in Bitcoin. Dozens of people. Only two people did it. They were too late. Oh, I can't be bothered. I haven't got time. And they said, but this is going to be the world. You're going to be living in a digital world. Maybe if you don't get on board now, firstly, you can make, you know, change your life. It's life-changing if you get in. It can still be life-changing now, but by next year,
might be too late.
It's very difficult because it's 250,000, you know, and you're going to buy a little tiny bit, you know. So I've been trying to help people like that. That's my job. I did a thing in Sarasota many years ago, like 15 years ago, and I said, I've dedicated my life in service to others. I don't go out looking for it. I don't basically put myself out there. I don't do videos. I don't do anything like that. But if anybody comes to me and says they need some help, I help. That's the way I live.
Fantastic. And I'm so glad we bumped into each other, and I'm learning so much from you. Great to have you as a friend. Michael Woodward, thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers.